welcome to Change Surfer Radio. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of our radically democratic future. Speaking today with Sally Lerner, she's a professor associated with the University of Waterloo. She taught there in environmental studies and is now emeritus and adjunct with them. She's the author of a 1999 volume, Basic Income, Economic Security for All Canadians, from Between the Lines Press. And she's an advocate of the position that we should all have a basic income through our governments so that we are not enslaved to the wage slavery system. Welcome, Sally.
Yes, thank you.
Now, I've also long advocated this notion. It was one of the original notions of the socialist movement that we should be freed from indebtedness to the wage slavery system. And then somewhere along the ways, it got perverted into the idea that we should all be given a job by the government rather than some income, but from the government. Do you think that this idea has a continuing resonance in the popular consciousness?
Well, I think it both has a continuing resonance and there's a continuing strong gut-level reaction against it, particularly in North America as contrasted, say, with Europe. And much of the thinking about basic income right now is coming out of Europe, where they've long had a much more of a tradition of social democracy and social investment in people and the whole idea that government is important to maintaining community and community well-being.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess my answer is that this is not a new idea. Actually, many people trace it back to Tom Paine, who had a similar kind of proposal. The reason that I became very interested in it about a decade ago is because I began to see the nature of work changing radically under the push from both new technologies and also what we like to call globalization. And what I began to be aware of, as were many others, was that the old concept of a permanent employment for everyone, adequately waged, with some security inherent in that, was going away. And what we were seeing is the call for what now the buzzword is for a flexible workforce, is what the private sector says it wants. And that usually means temporary jobs, contract jobs, few or no benefits, and just-in-time workers, which means that that social compact, if you will call it, that was built in to the idea of power holders hold power, but they also provide a means of employment and thereby livelihood, was going away. And when companies can move overseas and when unions are weak, you see it an imbalance that really I felt and others feel needs to be redressed. There has to be a quid pro quo. If a flexible workforce is what supposedly is required, then the trade-off has to be a basic secure income. Michelle?
So the basic argument is that it seems like a couple things. One is there's a basic fairness argument, a moral argument that people should not have to sell their souls into the marketplace for whatever wage is being offered. And then there's an economic argument that the nature of work and people's relationship to work is changing as with automation and globalization and so forth. Is that are those the two prongs on which you're basing the argument?
Yes, I believe they are. And there's an even broader argument, which is most disliked by right-wing people, which is that there's only one heritage that we all have, and that's the earth that belongs to all of us. And that somehow or other, there ought to be a more fair sharing out of everything that implies in terms of benefits, and that fair sharing out is not happening.
Mm-hmm. So the argument there would be, there's an environmental argument that also would go that we don't want to create more unnecessary work in the world because that will just use more resources.
Well, that's right. And that's another, I think, very valid argument given the environmental problems that we face.
Mm-hmm. Now, is your proposal for a basic income, how is it related to proposals for the shortening of the work week, the work life, and so forth? Do you see those as working in tandem? Because there's been some tangible progress on that those grounds in Europe as well,
yes.
The shortening of the work.
I do see them working in tandem.
Mm-hmm.
I think, and I also feel it's really important for people to understand that you could not simply have a basic income as a check in the mail, because it would have to be very basic, and it would need to be embedded in a societal context that provided support and resources for affordable housing, for access to health and education, and probably also a child care, a broad child care program.
So when we talk about expanding the social wage, we're not just talking about giving everyone money. We're talking about providing more benefits of a variety of kinds, health, free health insurance, child care, and so forth.
That's right. Our health system in Canada, I think, probably is one that meets more of that standard than the one in the U.S. does.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are a lot of folks, obviously, who have always and will continue to be horrified at this prospect.
That's right.
Because, and both on the left and the right, leftists who argue that we are ennobled through work, that leftists should never be for welfare. We should always be for the creation of work and job retraining and so forth. And, conservative people who want to expand the ranks of the reserve army of the unemployed so that capital will be able to make more profits. What will the productivity impacts be on an economy as it expands the social wage? Do you see there being positive economic benefits as well as the necessary negative ones?
Yes, and you put it very well. There are problems on the right and the left, which is what makes it a very tricky and challenging proposition to put forward. The productivity question, I think, is perhaps one that is very sticky, particularly in a knowledge-based economy. Very difficult to measure. I don't know if this is what you mean, but many people have worried about the incentives. In other words, if people are not under the whip, won't everyone just lie around at home and drink beer?
Mm-hmm.
So they've actually done some studies on that, where there's empirical evidence that no, that is not what people do.
Mm-hmm.
And the general feeling among people who are advocating a basic income is that it will benefit the economy on several counts. It will spread around what paid work there is. And nearly everyone will continue to seek paid work, because you would always be better off with paid work, because there's no clawback. It eliminates the poverty trap. And therefore, it does provide for the individual worker more choice and perhaps more flexibility in their own lives. Many people would rather work fewer hours and have more time for parenting and community involvement and so forth.
So your vision of a basic income would not be that we would, you would be able to have a house in the suburbs and two cars. It would be a pretty simple lifestyle.
It's a very simple lifestyle, but embedded in those other social resources, such as affordable housing, would be very important.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no house in the suburbs, no two cars. But you would have enough so that we could eliminate food banks for the most part. There would always, of course, have to be special resources for people with special needs, people who were disabled in some way, the mentally ill, et cetera. But that's just above and beyond what would be the average normal thing. And, of course, you could remove the entire apparatus of social welfare in that in the sense that it involves investigating people, trying to find out, you know, who's deserving, who's not, et cetera. All that goes away.
What about the argument that if we're going to have a society of a Volkshome, as the Swedes put it, you know, a society where we treat each other as family, that it's not just a matter of obligations to provide for people, but it's also a matter of citizenship obligations. And so that the workfare proposals that say that, you know, if we will provide you certain benefits, but you have to make a commitment to try to work or to provide community service or whatever. I mean, shouldn't there be some citizenship obligations?
Well, that's one of the points of contention, and I think it's one that's well worth arguing about. People like Jeremy Rifkin, for example, who wrote The End of Work, which I think is a misnamed book because it'll always be good work to do. But some people feel that there should be some sort of obligation that gets monitored. Others of us feel that people will anyway, as they do now in large numbers, involve themselves in volunteer and community work, as well as having adequate time for their children, which many people do not now. So that there are those of us who feel that the slippery slope toward workfare is just too slippery, and plus there would be additional transaction costs in monitoring and you know, keeping report cards on people. So
you would agree with those who say, for instance, in the United States, in a lot of high schools, there's a community service obligation now.
Yes.
And people say, well, you know, these kids should be doing that self-motivatedly, and if you make it a requirement, then you rob it of its intrinsic merit.
Well, it's interesting that you would raise the high school. Yes, I do. I don't think people should be compelled to do community service for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that with a new approach to earning a living and working, you could change the way we educate people so that, for example, there'd be more focus in the schools on cooperation as versus competition, and there would be and could be a norm that was set by example of the adults and was built into the curriculum that, well, of course everybody goes out and plants trees and helps pick up litter and, you know, all this kind of thing.
Now, Andre Gortz is one of the folks who's proposed these ideas. He's a French radical.
Yes, I'm well aware of Gortz.
And in his book, Paths to Paradise, back in the late 80s, he said, you know, automation is definitely going to take away a lot of necessary work and make it possible for us to reallocate the necessary work and reduce the work week and everything, unless capitalism invents all these leisure activities that then suckers us into having to work all these extra hours in order to pay for all these leisure activities.
Sounds like what's happening now.
Isn't it exactly what's happened?
Yeah. And I think that part of the basic income idea is that capitalism isn't going to have enough of that kind of work to sucker us into.
Mm-hmm.
If you see what I'm saying. In other
mm-hmm.
words...
They'll have the pursuits, but they won't have the work to allow us to
right.
pay for
and many,
them.
Yes, and so many people are terribly concerned that, for example, there simply will not be enough paid full-time work for that to serve as the basis for everyone's livelihood in society.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why people have come forward with these ideas, I believe. It's because there's a sense that there's both avoidance of a downside, which would, if you have lots and lots of people with who are the working poor, mm-hmm. which I find an extremely strange phrase, and then you have others who essentially can't even cobble together the semblance of a livelihood. You're courting social unrest. You're courting extreme political upheaval.
Yeah.
So that's the downside. On the upside, many people simply envision a much richer kind of life, which is focused less on the rat race of 9 to 5, and gives people indeed just more choices of what they want to do with their time and their lives. And I know Gortz has come. Gortz used to support community service.
Mm-hmm.
And conditionality. And his latest book, he, much to my delight, he came out in favor of no conditions
mm-hmm.
on a basic income.
Now, you mentioned the potential for social discord. I spent 2 years in Sri Lanka, and Sri Lanka is a country had a very successful social democratic post-colonial regime, educated a lot of college students who then couldn't find jobs, and then they all tromped off and became guerrillas of one sort or another.
And, there's a fine example.
And the country's been in civil war for the last 25 years. So
yes.
The possibilities, perhaps not civil war in the Western countries, but as we have a growing aging population, a shrinking relationship between workers who are supporting folks who are not working, it seems like the proposal for basic income might be a way to ameliorate, to establish that we all have a right to a basic income, and it's not just the elderly sucking off of the working young.
That's exactly right, and that is one of the major arguments for universality. Many people say, well, why not just target those in need, you know, who are worthy? And universality generally means that you will get political support and continuing political support for whatever the benefit is, so that you will not get the raison d'etre. You won't get people feeling there's us and them, because everybody gets the benefit.
Yeah, the means testing of Medicaid, which is our program for the poor, and only provides 30-40% of the costs of a health care bill,
right,
versus Medicare, which is the closest thing we have to a universal entitlement in the United States,
right,
which is very well funded, and so
and very well defended.
Yes, exactly.
You wouldn't want to rouse ARP about that one.
Exactly, and the Canadian healthcare system is even better supported because it is truly universal.
That's right. It's one of the centerpieces of Canadian values.
Now, the thing that's putting all of our welfare states and all of these proposals under pressure is globalization, and there's an enormous debate about whether socialism in one country, a welfare state in one country, is truly possible anymore. There are some like Doug Henwood of the Left Business Observer who argues that the United States, that North America, is relatively insular from the rest, from these global pressures, and that the American and North American capitalist arguments that they have to ratchet down our welfare state in order to be internationally competitive is nonsense. And then there are others who say, well, you know, look at Europe, look at Sweden. They've all had to make concessions in order to remain competitive in an international marketplace by having less expensive welfare states. Do you see that pressure? Which side are you on that debate?
Well, first of all, I don't see this as socialism. I see this as a relatively simple, straightforward way of doing some of the things that you spoke about, of making the bridge between people who are not offered sufficient work to live and the rest of society. And I frankly feel that it would make American companies, although it's hard to tell anymore what's an American company, and that's one of the problems, but it would actually give business what they say they want. What they say they want are workers who are just in time, who can work a few hours or whatever it is that we need right now, and then they go away. And that is what business is calling for.
And business wouldn't have to provide benefits because the benefits would be provided through the society.
Well, yes. And so this way, it seems to me, business becomes competitive in the way that it says it wishes to become competitive. And meantime, of course, you are maintaining the requisite consumer demand base that you need. The people at the bottom end spend every nickel, often in their home communities. And so
So you got just-in-time workers who don't need benefits, and you got healthy consumers.
That's right.
That's the perfect environment.
Put very well, yes.
Now, but is globalization making this impossible? So you're saying yes, you could ideally in a country make this this social compact and make profits. But if in a third world country you've got say China, you've got a dictatorship that super exploits their workers, refuses to have trade unions, provides a very meager welfare state. They've got an iron rice bowl, though it's shrinking. Can our welfare systems compete against that kind of system in an international capital market?
Well, that's a very good question. I think partly that depends on the extent to which, let's say, Americans or Canadians are willing to problem solve around the question of whether they are willing politically to have a race to the bottom or they're not.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a fan of the inevitability hypothesis about any of this,
mm-hmm.
and I also don't have any sense that that we have any solution for China's problems.
Mm-hmm.
But I know what you're saying. I mean, if somebody can make snow boots over in Malaysia for 50 cents a day,
right,
why would they be making them here?
Right,
and that's exactly, frankly, what led me to look seriously at a basic income, because our snow boot makers are moving over there, and there's not enough dot-com companies to take up the workers that would have been making the snow boots. And so, therefore, the question is, okay, what do you do? And if you want to continue to have a country and a society, you begin to think of alternative ways of handling your economic problems.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I do believe in is what I believe it's Richard Grossman and others are trying to look at ways to rein in, to put some limits around some of these capitalist organizations. One vision of globalization is so terrified, I think, that there's sort of a throwing up of hands and saying, well, there's just nothing we can do. And there are many people who don't believe that, among them Grossman and David Corton, who's a very sane writer about these developments. These are both U.S. people.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I've been a pessimist. I'm not a pessimist. I mean, I kind of believed that Marx turned out to be right, that it took the worldwide immiseration before we would link up. But I didn't expect the linking up of social movements against capitalism to happen quite so soon. But I think the April demonstrations in Seattle and the growing movement against globalization has really taken me by surprise. It seems like there is a global awareness now that we're being driven to the lowest common denominator.
Well, it seems to be coming, and I guess my belief about basic income, and I'm always bolstered by my European friends who have been meeting regularly and writing on this for 20 years, is that it's, as one person put it, you have to have something positive. You can't just go to the streets. And this idea, which needs, of course, debate and democratic consideration in its details, at least it's like, as one person put it, it's like you're building the furniture out in the garage, waiting for the time when you can move it into the house.
Mm-hmm.
And in some ways, I think that having worked in the environmental movement for many years, it's not enough to be against something. You have to have something to offer that people can discuss and think about.
So historically, it's like those who advocated the end of child labor and the 8-hour work week and national health insurance systems for 50 years before they were ever implemented.
That's exactly the way I look at it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Now, on one way that people can participate in this project of yours and ours for the reform of work is through the Future Work Forum. Can you say a bit about what happens on Future Work Forum?
Well, Future Work is a list, and it's an open discussion list. And on it, we have been able to, I think the best service it has provided is bringing together people who are interested in these questions. And so we've had it since December 94, and we've had periods when it was just a great bunch of noise, but we've had other really productive periods when we've had dialogues around all of the issues that are raised by this sea change in the nature of work and around the questions of basic income. And this past year, I started another list just for basic income because there are some people who would rather discuss other aspects of the future of work.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a basic income list as well.
Do you have the website? I have a website that people can go to see some of the things you've written, and that's www.geocities.com/ tildeubinz/sallylearner.html. And that has a couple of your essays there, and I guess it's the Universal Basic Income of New Zealand site.
Yes, I was out there to give a keynote speech to their annual meeting a couple years ago.
Mm-hmm. But where can people find the basic income list?
Basic income list is basic income, all one word, lowercase, at scribe, S-C-R-I-B-E, dot uwaterloo, all one word, .ca.
Great. I've been speaking with Sally Lerner. She's an advocate of the concept that all citizens should be given a basic income so that we are not slaves of the wage system. And she's been working for this for some time, and we'll hope we continue to work for it until we see it, maybe sometime in the next 50 years.
Right.
I really want to thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for asking me.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about radical democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. Also, check out past and future shows and myriad relevant links at the website, www.changesurfer.com.